Hari Om Sahana Bhavatu Sahana Bhavatu Sahaveyam Karavavahai
Greg, when these drug people on the Lower East Side came and talked to Swamiji, he was so patient with them. He was speaking on a philosophy which they had never heard before. When someone takes LSD, they're really into themselves, and they don't hear properly when someone talks to them. So Swamiji would make particular points, and they wouldn't understand him. So he would have to make the same point again. He was very patient with these people, but he would not give in to their claim that LSD was a bona fide spiritual aid to self-realization. October 1966. Tompkins Square Park was the park on the Lower East Side. On the south, it was bordered by 7th Street with its 4- and 5-story brownstone tenements. On the north side was 10th. With more brownstones, but in better condition. And the very old small building that housed the Tompkins Square branch of the New York Public Library. On Avenue B, the park's east border, stood St. Bridget's Church, built in 1848, when the neighborhood had been entirely Irish. The church, school, and rectory still occupied much of the block. And the west border of the park, Avenue A, was lined with tiny old candy stores, selling newspapers, magazines, cigarettes, and egg cream sodas at the counter. There were also a few bars, several grocery stores, and a couple of Slavic restaurants specializing in inexpensive vegetable broths, which brought Ukrainians and hippies side by side for bodily nourishment. The park's 10 acres held many tall trees, but at least half the park was paved. A network of 5-foot-high heavy wrought iron fences weaved through the park, lining the walkways and protecting the grass. The fences and the many walkways and entrances to the park gave it the effect of a maze. Since the weather was still warm and it was Sunday, the park was crowded with people. Almost all the space on the benches that lined the walkways was occupied. There were old people, mostly Ukrainians, dressed in outdated suits and sweaters, even in the warm weather, sitting together in clans, talking. There were many children in the park also, mostly Puerto Ricans and black, but also fair-haired, hard-faced slum kids, racing around on bikes or playing with balls and frisbees. The basketball and handball courts were mostly taken by the teenagers. And as always, there was plenty of loose running dogs. A marble miniature gazebo, 4 pillars and a roof with a drinking fountain inside, was a remnant from the old days, 1891. According to the inscription, on its 4 sides were the words hope, faith, charity, and temperance. But someone had sprayed the whole structure with black paint, making crude designs and illegible names and initials. Today a bench had been taken over by several conga and bongo drummers, and the whole park pulsed with their demanding rhythms. And the hippies were there, different from the others. The bearded Bohemian men and their long-haired young girlfriends dressed in old blue jeans were still an unusual sight. Even in the Lower East Side melting pot, their presence created tension. They were from middle-class families, and so they had not been driven to the slums by dire economic necessity. This created conflicts in their dealings with the underprivileged immigrants. And the hippies' well-known proclivity for psychedelic drugs, their revolt against their families and affluence, and their absorption in the avant-garde sometimes made them the jeering minority among their neighbors. But the hippies just wanted to do their own thing and create their own revolution for love and peace. So usually they were tolerated, although not appreciated. There were various groups among the young and hip at Tompkins Square Park. There were friends who had gone to the same school together, who took the same drug together, or who agreed on a particular philosophy of art, literature, politics, or metaphysics. There were lovers. There were groups hanging out together for reasons undecipherable, except for the common purpose of doing their own thing. And there were others who lived like hermits. A loner would sit on a park bench, analyzing the effects of cocaine, looking up at the strangely rustling green leaves of the trees and the blue sky above the tenements, and then down at the garbage at his feet, as he helplessly followed his mind from fear to illumination, to disgust to hallucination, on and on, until after a few hours, the drug began to wear off and he was again a common stranger. Sometimes they would sit up all night, spaced out, in the park, until at last, in the light of morning, they would stretch out on benches to sleep. Hippies especially took to the park on Sundays. They at least passed through the park on their way to St. Mark's Place, Greenwich Village, or the Lexington Avenue subway at Astor Place, or the IND subway at Houston and Second, or to catch an uptown bus on First Avenue, a downtown bus on Second, or a crosstown on Ninth. Or they went to the park just to get out of their apartments and sit together in the open air, to get high again, to talk, or to walk through the park's maze of pathways. But whatever the hippies' diverse interests and drives, the Lower East Side was an essential part of the mystique. It was not just a dirty slum. It was the best place in the world to conduct the experiment in consciousness. For all its filth and threat of violence and the confined life of its brownstone tenements, the Lower East Side was still the forefront of the revolution in mind expansion. Unless you were living there and taking psychedelics or marijuana, or at least intellectually pursuing the quest for free personal religion, you weren't enlightened, and you weren't taking part in the most progressive evolution of human consciousness. And it was this searching, a quest beyond the humdrum existence of the ordinary, materialistic, straight American, that brought unity to the otherwise eclectic gathering of hippies on the Lower East Side. Bhaktivinoda Thakur says that the materialists, they gathered together for three reasons. There's three groups. One is that you identify with, you know, a family or a particular, basically family or some other bodily consideration. The second is that there's some social or communal kind of consideration. And the third is that you have some similar ideology, some similar philosophy. So you see, basically here is that that's it. They have a common philosophy that, you know, you just do whatever you do, whatever you like and everything like that. So that would make them a community. So that was very different from the others who are like there's Ukrainians are there, the Puerto Ricans, or there's some group, and that they're there because the area is cheap, they don't have much money, so they're living there until they can, get themselves better situated and then move out of the area. But all these kids are coming from all over the place, and they're all from, you know, good families and all that. And they're rejecting everything and moving into this area, so that means it's harder to get places, rent goes up, all these different things. Plus, no one quite understands this, you know, weirdo group. So, like that. So in their minds, this was like where it was happening. Everybody was here. They're all getting together like this. So this would be the place. It was some time also. Not sure, we'll read about it after. Is that then also a similar kind of situation developed on the West Coast in San Francisco, like that. The place, there was a, the area was where Haight Street crossed with Ashbury. So it was called Haight-Ashbury. By, you know, that's the standard, or by those who live there, they call it Hashbury. Into this chaotic pageant, Swamiji entered with his followers and sat down to hold a kirtan. Three or four devotees who arrived ahead of him selected an open area of the park, put out the oriental carpet Robert Nelson had donated, sat down on it, and began playing kartals and chanting Hare Krishna. Right. Yeah, so as you can imagine, they're walking down the street with this carpet, you know, it'll be big, you know, like the one we have upstairs, you know, it'll be like that. So then you have, what do you call it, you know, it's a whole bunch of line of, you know, hippies walking down the street with this carpet, you know, so that should be interesting. Immediately, some boys rode up on their bicycles, braked just short of the carpet, and stood astride their bikes, curiously and irreverently staring. Other passers-by gathered to listen. Meanwhile, Swamiji, accompanied by half a dozen disciples, was walking the 8 blocks from the storefront. Brahmananda carried the harmonium and the Swami's drum. Kirtananda, who was now shaven-headed at Swamiji's request and dressed in loose, flowing, canary-yellow robes, created an extra sensation. I guess he was the first one to wear devotional clothes. Oh, when we're saying here the Ravindra Sroop, that's not the Ravindra Sroop that we know here, you know, in Philadelphia and that. This is someone else like that. It's a different, earlier. Drivers pulled their cars over to have a look. Their passengers leaning forward, agape at the outrageous dress and shaven head. As the group passed the store, people inside would poke each other and indicate the spectacle. People came to the windows of their tenements, taking in the Swami and his group as if a parade were passing. The Puerto Rican tough guys, especially, couldn't restrain themselves from exaggerated reactions. "Hey, Buddha," they taunted. "Hey, you forgot to change your pajamas." They made shrill screams as if imitating Indian war whoops they had heard in Hollywood westerns. They can't make the distinction here like that. And one time, when a devotee was going, he said, he was going to a program. You know, he dressed as a devotee and that. And in New York, you have all the buildings are just these brick or stone buildings like this. That are exactly on the sidewalk. There's no grass or anything, and the steps come right down onto the sidewalk. So the only place, if you want to go outside your house, is to sit on the those steps, which would be called the stoop. You know, so you go sit on the stoop. So devotees were going into this building to do a program, some other devotee's house or that, and there was some guy sitting on the stoop. So when they walked by, then he asked one of the devotees, "What's with the bed sheets?" You know, the sheets that you put on the bed, you know, because they're wearing the dhotis and that. So what's with the bed sheets? The devotee turned to him, because he's also from New York, and said, "The blankets were dirty." To the back, "Oh, okay." It's just the thing about New York. If you come back with a clever answer, then they go, "Okay, yeah, no problem." "Hey, Arabs," exclaimed one heckler, who began imitating what he thought was an Eastern dance. No one on the street knew anything about Krishna consciousness, nor even of Hindu culture and customs. To them, the Swami's entourage was just a bunch of crazy hippies showing off. But they didn't quite know what to make of the Swami. He was different. Nonetheless, they were suspicious. Some, however, like Irving Halpern, a veteran Lower East Side resident, felt sympathetic towards this stranger who was, quote, apparently a very dignified person on a peaceful mission. Irving Halpern. A lot of people had specularized notions of what a Swami was, and though they were going to suddenly see people suddenly see people lying on little mattresses made out of nails and all kinds of other absurd notions. Yet here came just a graceful, peaceful, gentle, obviously well-meaning being into a lot of hostility. Then continuing the local, what would they say? The Puerto Rican tough guys. Hippies. What are they? Communists? While the young taunted, the middle-aged and elderly shook their heads or stared, cold and uncomprehending. The way to the park was spotted with blasphemies, ribald jokes, and tension, but no violence. After the successful kirtan in Washington Square Park, Prabhupada had regularly been sending out parades of three or four devotees, chanting and playing hand cymbals through the streets and sidewalks of the Lower East Side. On one occasion, they had been bombarded with water balloons and eggs, and they were sometimes faced with bullies looking for a fight. But they were never attacked, just stared at, laughed at, or shouted after. Today, the ethnic neighbors just assumed that Prabhupada and his followers had come onto the streets dressed in outlandish costumes as a joke, just to turn everything topsy-turvy and cause stares and howls. They felt that their responses were only natural for any normal, respectable American slum dweller. Okay. So it was quite an adventure before the group even reached the park. Swamiji, however, remained unaffected. "What are they saying?" he asked once or twice, and Brahmananda explained. Prabhupada had a way of holding his head high, his chin up, as he walked forward. It made him look aristocratic and determined. His vision was spiritual. He saw everything. He saw everyone as a spirit soul, and Krishna as the controller of everything. Yet, aside from that, even from a worldly point of view, he was unafraid of the city's pandemonium. After all, he was an experienced Calcutta man. Right? Because whatever there is, you can see it in Calcutta. Like that. So it's not like there's anything different, you know, over there. The kirtan had been going on for about 10 minutes when Swamiji arrived, stepped out of his white rubber shoes, just as he were home in the temple, sat down on the rug with his followers, who had now stopped their singing and were watching him. He wore a pink sweater and was round his shoulders a khadi wrapper. A wrapper is a chadar. He smiled, looking at his group. He indicated the rhythm by counting, 1, 2, 3. Then he began clapping his hands heavily as he continued counting, 1, 2, 3. The kartals followed, at first with wrong beats, but he kept the rhythm by clapping his hands, and then they got it, clapping hands, clashing the cymbals artlessly to a slow, steady beat. So it's interesting that, you know, Haisa, because he starts the whole kirtan by him clapping his hand and counting, because otherwise they can't catch the beat, but eventually then they get it. As he sang, Shri Rupam Sagrajatam, the dogs came by. The kids stared. A few mockers pointed fingers. "Hey, who is that priest man?" Oh, no, I think the man was for the other guy. "Hey, who is that priest, man?" But his voice was a shelter beyond the clashing dualities. His boys went on ringing cymbals while he sang alone. Shri Radha Krishna Padan. Prabhupada sang prayers and praise of the pure conjugal love for Radha, for Krishna of Srimati Radharani, the beloved of the gopis. Each word passed down for hundreds of years, by the intimate associates of Krishna, was saturated with deep transcendental meaning that only he understood. Sahagana Lalita Sri Vishakhan Vitam Cha. They waited for him to begin Hare Krishna, although hearing him chant was exciting enough. Some people came, which was what Prabhupada wanted. He wanted them chanting and dancing with him, and now his followers wanted that too. They wanted to be with him. They had tried together at the UN, Anand Ashram, and Washington Square. It seems that this would be the thing they would always do. Go with Swamiji and sit and chant. He would always be with them, chanting. Then he began the mantra, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. They responded, too low and muddled at first, but he returned it to them again, singing it right and triumphant. Again they responded, gaining heart, ringing kartals and clapping hands, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. Again he sang it alone, and they stayed, hanging closely on each word, clapping, beating cymbals, and watching him, looking back at them from his inner concentration. His old age wisdom, his bhakti, and out of love for Swamiji, they broke loose from their surroundings and joined him as a chanting congregation. Swami played his small drum, holding a strap in his left hand, bracing the drum against his body, and with his right hand playing intricate mridanga rhythms. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. He was going strong after half an hour, repeating the mantra, carrying them with him as interested onlookers gathered in great numbers. A few hippies sat down on the edge of the rug, copying the cross-legged sitting posture, listening, clapping, trying the chanting, and the smaller inner circle of Prabhupada and his followers grew as gradually more people joined. So Prabhupada wasn't disturbed because he knows this is the standard. You know, it's just like if you go into if you went into an insane asylum, right? Everybody in there is crazy. So in their minds, you look different than them. So they start jeering and saying all kinds of crazy things and pointing their fingers and laughing. Would you feel, oh, I have to adjust and look crazy like everybody else here? No, you would know they're crazy. So therefore, crazy people do this. So that's the point, Prabhupada is saying. We go out into the world, people may think it's weird or funny or this or that, but that's okay. That's because they're crazy. So, you know, it doesn't matter. Also, it's interesting to note that the hippies, even though they're so, misdirected, but they're willing to try. So therefore, the kirtan's going on. It's only the hippies that are coming forward and sitting down and taking part. Others are just standing around watching. Right, so then that's very good. As always, his kirtan attracted musicians. Irving Halpern, I make flutes and I play musical instruments. There are all kinds of different instruments that I make. When the Swami came, I went up and started playing, and he welcomed me. Whenever a new musician would join and play their first note, he would extend his arms. It would be as though he had stepped up to the podium, I was going to lead the New York Philharmonic. I mean, there was this gesture that every musician knows. You know when someone else wants you to play with them and feels good that you're playing with them. And this very basic kind of musician communication was there with him, and I related to it very quickly, and I was happy about it. Because musicians would come, and so if there are some other musicians, then he would play, they would welcome. You know, so they had kind of their own unspoken language. So Prabhupada would also relate in that language. So that was the thing, is whoever it was, they always felt that Prabhupada would relate on their own platform, whoever they were. Lone musicians were always loitering in different parts of the park. And when they heard they could play with the Swami's chanting and that they were welcome, They began to come by one by one. Because it's one thing they go and play, but you're just not interested. But here, it's like they'd like you to be part. Like that. So some of those who, you know, would have seen that in the old days, I've seen also, like, Indudu Namars, Govindamars. They'll be doing Harinam down the street, and they'll come across a street musician, you know, playing some kind of instrument or that. And they'll stop there and somehow get him involved in the kirtan. And they'll play and everything like that. And then after some time, you know, then they'll move on. But they'll always engage all these musicians. A saxophone player came just because there was such a strong rhythm section to play with. Others, like Irving Halpern, saw it as something spiritual with good vibrations. As the musicians joined, more passerbys were drawn into the kirtan. Prabhupada had been singing both lead and chorus, and many who had joined now sang the lead part also, so that there was a constant chorus of chanting. During the afternoon, the crowd grew to more than 100, with a dozen musicians trying, with their conga and bongo drums, bamboo flutes, metal flutes, mouth organs, wood and metal clackers, tambourines and guitars to stay with the Swami. Irving Halpern. The park resounded. The musicians were very careful in listening to the mantras. When the Swami sang Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare, there was sometimes a Krishna, a tripling of what had been a double syllable. It would usually be on the first stanza. And the musicians really picked up on it. The Swami would pronounce it in a particular way, and the musicians were very meticulous and listened very carefully to the way the Swami would sing. And we began to notice that there were different melodies for the same brief sentence. And we got to count on that one regularity, like one would count on the conductor of an orchestra or the lead singer of a madrigal. It was really pleasant, and people would dig one another in their ribs. They would say, hey, see? We would catch and repeat a particular subtle pronunciation of a Sanskrit phrase that the audience in their enthusiasm, while they would be dancing or playing, had perhaps missed. Or the Swami would add an extra beat, but it meant something in the way in which the drummer, who at that time was the Swami, the main drummer, would hit the drums. I have talked to a couple of musicians about it, and we agreed that in his head, this Swami must have had hundreds and hundreds of melodies that had been brought back from the real learning from the other side of the world. So many people came there just to tune in to the musical gift, the transmission of the Dharma. Hey, they would say, listen to this holy monk. People were really sure there were going to be unusual feats. Grandstanding, flashy levitation, or whatever people expected was going to happen. But when the simplicity of what the Swami was really saying, when you began to sense it, whether you were motivated to actually make a lifetime commitment and go this way of life, or whether you merely wanted to appreciate it and place it in a place and give certain due respect to it, it turned you around. Yeah, so Prabhupada, so it means one of the qualities of an expert musician is that whenever they sing the tune, that there'll always be some slight variation in it. It's the same tune, but there's some differences in it. So the audience, the chorus responds in the basic tune, unless they're expert enough to be able to follow. But otherwise, they use the main tune, but the lead singer will use all these variations in it, like that. So Prabhupada was doing that. So that's what the musicians are picking up on. Is every time there's some slight little change, some little nuance. That's how they knew he must really, you know, have so much in his head. Like that. So that's the thing, is if one understands how the ragas work, then one can do this very easily. Otherwise, if one's just very good and practices a musician, then one can create all this variety. So the musicians, it wasn't just something to play along and all that. They were actually interested in the elements of the music. Right? So that's the thing, is if you use all these modern instruments and all that, that's one thing. But the thing is most will be playing modern music. Prabhupada wasn't. He was playing the traditional classical music. But it was because of its nature, it's so universal, so primordial, that these other musicians could pick up that here is something very interesting, even though it's so simple. The tunes Prabhupada used are so simple. You know, but they could catch the way, the subtleties of the beats and the way he'd use the melody, that, you know, here is someone who really, really knows music, right? So that would, all these musicians would really appreciate that. And that was interesting too, the different ways in which people regarded the kirtans. Some people thought it was a prelude. Some people thought it was a main event. Some people liked the music. Some people liked the poetic sound of it. Then Allen Ginsberg and Peter Orlovsky arrived, along with some of their friends. Allen surveyed the scene and found a seat amongst the chanters. With his black beard, his eyeglasses, his bald spot surrounded by long black ringlets of hair, Allen Ginsberg, the poet patriarch, came to join the chanting. Greatly enhanced. Oh, let's see, what is it? Greatly enhanced the local prestige of the kirtan. Prabhupada, while continuing his ecstatic chanting and drum playing, acknowledged Allen and smiled. A reporter from the New York Times stopped by and asked Allen for an interview, but he refused. A man should not be disturbed while worshiping. The Times would have to wait. Allen. Tompkins Square Park was a hotbed of spiritual conflict in those days. It was absolutely great. All of a sudden, in the midst of all the talk and drugs and theory, for some people to put their bodies, their singing, to break through the intellectual ice and come out with total bhakti, that was really amazing. The blacks and Puerto Ricans were out there with drums too, doing conga. But there was a totally different kind of group. But here was a totally different kind of group. Some of them were shaven heads, and it was interesting. It was a repetitious chant, but that was also great. It was an easy chant to get into. It was an open scene. There was no boxed corner there in the actual practice. So general smiles and approval and encouragement as a beginning of some kind of real communal get-together in the park, with a kind of serious underbase for exchange, instead of just hog dog on the drums. Oh yeah, that was all Allen Ginsberg. Right, in other words, so it was appreciated, the pleasantness was there, at the same time as there was other underlying depth and seriousness to the whole thing. It's that whole combination that you felt comfortable to join, but you also knew this was something spiritual. Prabhupada was striking to see. His brow was furrowed in an effort of singing loud, and his visage was strong. The veins in his temples stood out visibly, and his jaw jutted forward as he sang his Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare, for all to hear. Although his demeanor was pleasant, his chanting was intensive, sometimes straining. And everything about him was concentration. It wasn't someone else's yoga retreat or silent peace vigil, but a pure chanting bhajan of Prabhupada's own doing. It was a new wave, something everyone could take part in. The community seemed to be accepting it. It became so popular that the ice cream vendor came over to make sales. Yeah. Ratdeka Kola Becha, right? Watch the kirtan and sell your ice cream, so he gets both. But Prabhupada's group, beside Prabhupada, a group of young, blonde-haired boys, 5 or 6 years old, were just sitting around. A young Polish boy stood staring. Someone began burning frankincense on a glowing coal in a metal strainer, and the sweet fumes billowed amongst the flautists, drummers, and chanters. Swamiji motioned to his disciples, and they got up and began to dance. Tall, thin Sri Adish, his back pocket stuffed with Stay High Forever flyers, raised his hands and began to dance. Beside him, in a black turtleneck, big chanting beads around his neck, danced Achyutananda, his curly, almost frizzy hair long and disarrayed. Then Brahmananda got up. He and Achyutananda stood facing each other, arms outstretched as in the picture of Lord Chaitanya's kirtan. Photographers in the crowd moved forward. The boys danced, shifting their weight from left foot to right foot, striking a series of angelic poses, their large red chanting beads around their necks. They were doing the Swami step. This one doesn't have. So I've seen a picture of that. We're doing that. Yeah, here it is. Ugh. Yeah, Prabhupada, and then that's the other. I said, oops, sorry.
Is that Ramananding and...
I'm not sure. I'm saying this is what they looked like, and that was the crowd that was there. This is October 10th, 66. Swami's flock chants in park to find ecstasy. October 10th. Yeah, so we were here in October. So this would have been that time. October 66, yeah. So this is from then. Who had his beads around his neck? Achyutananda. Brahmananda. Once I got up, I thought I would have to remain standing for as long as Swamiji played the drum. It will be an offense, I thought, if I sit down while he's still playing. So I danced for an hour. Prabhupada gave a gesture of acceptance by a typical Indian movement of his head. And then he raised his arms, inviting more dancers. More of his disciples began dancing, and even a few hippies got up and tried it. Prabhupada wanted everyone to sing and dance in kirtan. The dance was a sedate swaying and a stepping of bare feet on the rug. And the dancers' arms were raised high. Their fingers extended towards the sky above the branches of the autumn trees. Here and there throughout the crowd, chanters were enjoying private ecstasies. A girl with her eyes closed played finger cymbals and shook her head dreamily as she chanted. A Polish lady with a very old, worn face and a babushka around her head, stared incredulously at the girl. Little groups of old women in kerchiefs, some of them wearing sunglasses, stood here and there among the crowd, talking animatedly and pointing out the interesting sights in the kirtan. Kirtanananda was the only one in a dhoti, looking like a young version of Prabhupada. The autumn afternoon sunlight fell softly on the group, spotlighting them in a golden glow with long, cool shadows. The harmonium played a constant drone, and a boy wearing a military fatigue jacket improvised atonal creations on a wooden recorder. So the harmonium then, they didn't play the keys. I think they unhooked the one, whatever it was, the one they used, and then they just pumped it. So it was just a drone. So that's how they, you know, how one played harmonium. They can't even play kartals, so the harmonium is just makes the drone. And a recorder is kind of like a wooden, like clarinet kind of thing. It's kind of like a flute, but it's carved out of wood instead of being like bamboo. But here's atonal, means he wasn't actually playing anything that had anything to do with what they were playing. He just was playing something. Yet the total sound of the instruments blended, and Swamiji's voice emerged above the mulling tones of each chord. And so it went for hours. Prabhupada held his head and shoulders erect, although at the end of each line of the mantra, he would sometimes shrug his shoulders before he started the next line. His disciples stayed close by him, sitting on the same rug, religious ecstasy visible in their eyes. Finally, he stopped. Immediately, he stood up, and they know he was going to speak. It was 4 o'clock, and the warm autumn sun was still shining on the park. The atmosphere was peaceful, and the audience attentive and mellow from the concentration on the mantra. He began to speak to them, thanking everyone for joining in the kirtan. The chanting of Hare Krishna, he said, had been introduced 500 years ago in West Bengal by Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Hare means, O energy of the Lord. Krishna is the Lord. And Rama is also the name of the Supreme Lord, meaning the highest pleasure. His disciples sat at his feet, listening. Rai Rama squinted through his shielding hand into the sun to see Swamiji. And Kirtananda's head was cocked to one side, like a bird who is listening to the ground. He stood erect by the stout oak, his hands folded loosely before him in a proper speaker's pose, his light saffron robes covering him gracefully. The tree behind him seemed perfectly placed, and the sunshine dappled leafy shadows against the thick trunk. Behind him, through the grove of trees, was the steeple of St. Brigid's. On his right was a dumpy middle-aged woman, wearing a dress and hairdo that had been out of style in the United States for 25 years. On his left was a bold-looking hippie girl in tight denims, and beside her a young black man in a black sweater, his arms folded across his chest. Next was a young father holding an infant, then a bearded young street sadhu, his long hair parted in the middle, and two ordinary short-haired middle-class men and their young female companions. Many in the crowd, although standing close by, became distracted, looking off here and there. I'm not sure if that's a picture also. That's a very famous. That's this. I mean, this is not here, but that's that picture. It came out of the village other, East Village other. But there's all the. Prabhupada explained that there were three platforms: sensual, mental, and intellectual, and above them is the spiritual platform. The chanting of Hare Krishna is on the spiritual platform. And it is the best process for reviving our eternal blissful consciousness. He invited everyone to attend the meetings at 26 Second Avenue and concluded his brief speech by saying, "Thank you very much. Please chant with us." Then he sat down, took the drum, and began the kirtan again. If it were risky for a 71-year-old man to thump a drum and shout so loud, then he would take that risk for Krishna. It was too good to stop. He had come far from Vrindavan, survived the non-Krishna yoga society, waited all winter in obscurity. America had waited hundreds of years with no Krishna chanting. No Hare Krishna had come from Thoreau or Emerson's appreciations, although they had pored over English translations of the Gitas and Puranas. And no kirtan had come from Vivekananda's famous speech on behalf of Hinduism at the World Parliament of Religions in Chicago in 1893. So now that he finally had Krishna Bhakti going, flowing like the Ganges to the sea, it could not stop. In his heart, he felt the infinite will of Lord Chaitanya to deliver the fallen souls. He knew this was the desire of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, and his own spiritual master, even though caste-conscious Brahmins in India would disapprove of his associating with such untouchables as these drug-mad American meat-eaters and their girlfriends. But Swamiji explained that he was in full accord with the scriptures. The Bhagavatam had clearly stated that Krishna consciousness should be delivered to all races. Everyone was a spiritual soul, and regardless of birth, they could be brought to the highest spiritual platform by chanting the holy name. Never mind whatever sinful things they were doing, these people were perfect candidates for Krishna consciousness. Tompkins Square Park was Krishna's plan. It was also part of the earth, and these people were members of the human race, and the chanting of Hare Krishna was the dharma of the age. So others might, because if one looks with the external vision, one looks at it that it's the form that's important. But the form is to assist in actually what you're trying to do. Right? Like, just like you have a bucket and you have a spoon, and inside you have some sabji. So of all this, what's the important element? The sabji. But now, could you serve the sabji if you didn't have a bucket and spoon? Right? It'd be hard. You put it in your hat, maybe, or something. Yeah. You know, but so the bucket is, the form is important only because it carries the sabji. But many people, they take it, and then the bucket and the spoon are important, so they always, the bucket and spoon's always there, but there's no sabji in it. And they still are, you know, the bucket's very important and everything like this. They don't understand its importance is because the sabji is there. So same as the rules and regulations in the Vedic culture are important because they're for carrying devotional service to the Lord. But if it's not carrying devotional service, then it's not so useful. Does that make sense? Right? You know, so the problem comes is that many people take it, okay, these Westerners, they don't deal right, dress right, anything. But the point is they're chanting, they're doing devotional service. So the form is not so ideal. Like you have a bucket with a hole in it, it's not so ideal. Right? But the point is, you know, it's something to start with. Right? And then afterwards, then you'll fill all the holes.
Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
Srila Prabhupada ki, Sabhaveta Bhaktivrinda ki, Jayanitai Gaura Premanandi.